Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of our planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. This week, we'll take a look at some goings-on in Washington. Some feel that Congress is using the budget process to rewrite laws which protect the environment and natural resources. We'll speak with Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt and U.S. EPA Administrator Carol Browner. Author Bill McKibben will present a portrait of an Adirondack Creek. And then we'll travel to Ithaca, New York, and find out about efforts to repopulate lake sturgeons. These ancient animals were once so numerous they could be harvested with pitchforks. Now, scientists are working to reverse their impending extinction. Two people with conflicting views will lock horns over the question of whether we should sell off our national parks. And finally, it's autumn, a season of change all around the world. In our Earth calendar, we'll take a look at the migration of butterflies, creatures called the ears of the gods by primitive peoples. These stories coming up this week on The Environment Show.
This is the time of year when Congress decides how much money gets spent by various government agencies. But there's more at stake here than dollars. In the process of appropriating money, environmental laws are being changed. Two areas of environmental concern, curbing pollution and the management of our public lands and waters, are particularly affected. Peter Burley has more.
While the stated purpose of the federal budget process is to specify the amount of money we spend on federal programs, the administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Carol Browner, says that what is really going on is a campaign to gut environmental laws.
They are using the appropriations process to attack the environmental laws of this country, from the Clean Water Act to the toxic waste cleanup programs. What we've seen beginning in January with the Republican leadership is nothing less than a concerted, orchestrated effort to roll back the public health and environmental protections we have achieved in this country over the last 25 years. And this is all effort, quite frankly, to help the special interest, to create special loopholes for the special interest at the expense of the American people.
Browner's agency stands to emerge from the budget process with a mandate that has been substantially changed. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt is facing a similar challenge.
Congress, knowing that there is not much public support for rolling back environmental legislation, is now using the budget process as sort of a back doorway of beginning a repeal of environmental laws. For example, the Park Closure Commission, the effective attempt to repeal the California Desert Mojave National Park legislation, changes in the mining law, the Livestock Grazing Act, opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling for oil, tremendous cutbacks in funding for the science agencies, just to name a few. Balancing the budget is not what this is about. That's simply a fig leaf, a disguise for a much deeper agenda of simply terminating national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges, public lands of all kinds.
Recognizing that the political process is an ongoing one, what is the strategy that you and the Clinton administration plan to employ to deal with this phenomenon?
Well, what's happening, in my judgment, is that the lobbyists are swarming through the temples of democracy on Capitol Hill. That these provisions are being written by lobbyists who are up there saying, it's our turn. We financed the electoral victory in November, and now it's our turn. The initial response of the Congress, I think, was, you know, wait a minute, we didn't hear these issues debated in the last election, and indeed they weren't. The lobbyists are responding, well, you know, that's not the issue. It was our money that helped purchase this electoral victory, and this is our menu. And now Congress is responding by attempting to do this kind of sneak attack style to get it done quickly, by subverting the normal legislative process, bundling it up, and hoping it'll pass quietly and that the American people will not really notice that it's going on. So I think the real issue is to try to put some sunshine onto this process, to pull it out into the open.
Secretary Babbitt is also concerned about provisions in the budget bills which declare that some projects are exempt from environmental laws. For example, one particular budget bill requires additional timber cutting in national forests and specifies that legal protections for streams and endangered species will not apply.
And so what the Congress is doing is responding to the lobbyists by saying, we don't dare take these laws head on. But if you'll give us something we can do kind of below the radar in terms of one project at a time or provisions in unrelated pieces of legislation, well, we're glad to do it. And you see those popping up again and again and again. But the end result is the same, an effective destruction of the fabric of environmental protection that we've built up over the last couple of decades.
Bruce Babbitt is the United States Secretary of the Interior. Using the budget process to change law and policy is not new. Environment Show reporter Linda Anderson speaks with Professor Joe White, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute.
Budgeting has always been a nasty process, regardless of who's in power. This year's Congress is no different. Professor White expects many proposals will be altered between now and the time they're signed into law. But, he says, proposals with the best chances of passing are those buried in budget legislation, because they're hidden from public view, a familiar tactic on Capitol Hill.
In previous years, people like Mr. Babbitt were quite happy to see proposals to change it in the appropriations process, but it is not inherently true that that doing things through the appropriations is undemocratic. On the other hand, you know, in many particular cases this year, what the Republicans are trying to do through the appropriations process is probably unpopular. That is particularly true, I suspect, of many of the things they want to do on environmental protection.
Professor White says these kinds of actions were last seen after the Republicans took over Congress in 1947. At that time, Democrats had just lost the Congress after many years of control, and Republicans were eager to scale down the government after years of post-war expansion. For the Environment Show, I'm Linda Anderson.
The Environment Show welcomes your comments. You can write us at P.O. Box 66600, Albany, New York, 12206-6600. Or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. Still ahead, a portrait of an Adirondack Creek from author Bill McKibben. Bill Chandler from the National Parks and Conservation Association will lock horns with Jerry Taylor from the Cato Institute over whether we should sell off our national parks. And our Earth calendar will celebrate autumn and the migration of the butterflies.
We all have a place which is special to us. For some, it's a place in the city. For others, it's a place deep in the wilderness. Bill McKibben's most recent book is Hope, Human and Wild. He lives in the Adirondack Mountains of New York and has this portrait of place.
I'm watching the stream that runs by my house. It's more a seep, really, after this summer of drought, a collection of pools and puddles with water threading between them. When people first arrived in this part of New York's Adirondack Mountains, they called this stream Beaver Brook after its main inhabitants. But the name didn't last too long. From where I sit, I can see the remains of an old stone dam that three generations ago powered a small sawmill, one of 23 mills that once harnessed the power of this single little creek before it flowed away into the Hudson. There were tanneries, grist mills, a calico mill, and the name of the stream became Mill Creek. The sawmill's gone now, and all the rest. People overcut the trees and the surrounding land, and then the state stepped in to buy and protect much of the area. Now it's growing back in. Great stands of hemlock and maple and oak, 50 and 75 years old, a real forest filled with bear and bobcat, fisher and marten. It's proof that if people can back off a little, the natural world still possesses vigor enough to stage a comeback. And that includes the beaver. The species was once all but wiped out in the Adirondacks, both by overtrapping and loss of habitat. It's long since returned. There's hardly a stream in these mountains that doesn't support a lodge or two of beavers. And they're constantly at work, the most critical kind of work. Without having read a single mailing from a single environmental group about the importance of wetlands, they nonetheless spend all day creating them. If I turn my head from the old sawmill dam, in fact, I can see a beaver dam, built to contain about the same head of water. Behind it, a murky, slimy pond has grown, filled with all the vibrant life that particularly enjoys murk and slime. It's a lot noisier here since the beaver's built. Frogs and bugs of every pitch and timbre. One of the businesses that's opened in town to replace the old mills is a sporting goods store, an outfitter who equips and guides people into the beauty of the surrounding woods. The small store is right on the creek, and it's called Beaver Brook Outfitters, an old name for an old reality and for a new one. At least in this one place, the map of the wild has pushed back up through the plans of man. The sound of water trickling over that beaver dam is the sound of hope.
Bill McKibben is the author of Hope, Human and Wild. Imagine lakes and streams inhabited by fish, 5 feet long and weighing over 200 pounds. Well, a little more than 100 years ago, such animals thrived across a vast section of northern North America. But today, lake sturgeons are in a familiar predicament, reduced to near extinction. Thomas Lally reports on an effort in upstate New York to bring these creatures back.
Fall Creek in Ithaca, New York, drops about 90 feet into a pool of water. Anglers know this area as a prime spot for trout and walleye. But one species of fish has been here longer than any other. Lake sturgeons have roamed these parts for the past 100 million years. But while having survived the dinosaurs, along with countless ice ages, lake sturgeons are now struggling to survive.
Fishermen didn't like them. River boatmen didn't like them when they spawned in the rapids. They were big. Very abundant, and it was common where I grew up in that general area on Lake Huron, Saginaw Bay City, Michigan, to see sturgeons stacked up on the beaches or along the riverbanks, and then they would dry down enough to light them on fire, and then they would burn them. And they even used them to fuel boilers on steamboats.
Tom Sciotti is a senior aquatic biologist with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. His department has released thousands of sturgeons into the lakes and rivers in upstate New York in the hopes they'll one day return. Lake sturgeons are unusual animals. Aside from the fact that they aren't predators, they're a lot like sharks. Both have cartilage skeletons and share a similar digestive system. Still, not much is known about these creatures in the wild. Shadi says sturgeons were reduced to near extinction in only about 25 years.
The sturgeon have been here, 30 times longer than we've been here? And that's the real interest in terms of reintroducing them into this aquatic system, is that they were taken out of here in a very short period of time by man.
But are sturgeons worth all this trouble? It wasn't so long ago when these animals were seen as pests. There were so many of them that they sometimes impeded navigation in rivers. But around the end of the last century, the market for their meat and eggs exploded, securing further reductions in their numbers. Shadi admits there probably won't be much commercial use for sturgeons, and since they'll be protected for the foreseeable future, anglers will be forbidden from catching them. But utility is not something Shadi worries about.
My feeling is sturgeon doesn't have to have some economic value. It doesn't have to have a lot of work, doesn't have to have the fastest swimming speed, any number of characteristics that might be desirable by a fishing fraternity. As a biologist, I look at the species as something that's maybe even got superior capabilities to my own species, because it's been here 100 million. Wait until we can say that. I don't know if we're ever going to be able to say that we've been here 100 million years. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the sturgeon has been here that long. So I believe, as a biologist, it deserves to be here when I leave.
Sturgeons live for 150 to 300 years. They don't begin reproducing till they're between 25 and 35 years old. So the success of the sturgeon program in upstate New York won't even be known till most of us are dead. Even though lake sturgeons will probably never reach their former numbers, our grandchildren may one day be able to see prehistoric behemoths once again swim through the waterways of the North. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. Bill Chandler, Vice President of the National Parks and Conservation Association, locks horns with Jerry Taylor, Director of Natural Resource Studies at the Cato Institute. The question is, should we consider closing some of our national parks as we seek to balance the budget? Mr. Chandler?
Absolutely not, Peter. Closing parks is a bogus argument, and it's not going to save a lot of money. The park budget makes up less than 0.1% of the federal budget right now. This whole idea that parks ought to be closed is being advanced by a handful of Western congressmen who I think are out of step with the American public. Americans love their parks, both the big ones and the small ones, and they want to see them protected. Visitation, for example, has doubled in the last 20 years. Instead of closing parks, what Congress ought to do is find better ways of financing our parks. In the first place, they ought to be giving the parks an adequate share of the tax dollars we already send to Washington. Secondly, Congress should require park concessionaires to pay a fair share of their profits back to the parks. These business monopolies earned $650 million last year, but paid less than 3% of that to the taxpayer. That's outrageous, and it ought to stop.
Mr. Taylor.
Well, Peter, as the saying goes, a few hundred million dollars here and there, and pretty soon you add up to some real dollars. There's a lot of money sunk in our national parks, and Congress is rightfully looking at them as ways to help reduce the budget deficit. There are three reasons why we ought to be looking at national parks. First of all, parks are generally used as pork these days. For example, we have a steam engine national park in Pennsylvania, and we have a multitude now of rather dubious national landmarks that are simply there to help congressmen get reelected that even my friend Mr. Chandler would not be too happy about and probably would concede shouldn't be there. Second of all, the parks are a mess. Imagine the Postal Service running national landmarks, and you have a pretty good idea of how bad the environmental situation is at most of our natural parks. You have sewers running down the streets. You have ecological stress that is famous within the environmental and the free market community amongst analysts there, and they've generally helped muck up the environment, and they haven't done much to protect ecosystems. And finally, parks are nothing but generally recreational subsidies to wealthy Easterners. After all, parks aren't there generally to help protect the environment. They're there to provide recreational activities for Americans, and that's fine. But
Thank you. We
are not a socialist economy, and they
Mr.
should be
Chandler,
privatized where possible.
30 seconds in response.
Peter, the idea that there are a lot of bad apples in the park system is, we believe, false. Yeah, there may be a unit or two that does not belong there. But frankly, Congress has the power right now to deauthorize any unit of the park system that doesn't measure up. Yes, the Park Service has its problems. It needs to do a better job of managing the parks, but we think we ought to let the professionals do their job. Frankly, Congress has interfered in the park system tremendously over the last 10 to 12 years.
Mr. Taylor, the last word.
Well, the professionals have mucked up our national landmarks and parks, and virtually every environmentalist or analyst who looked at the parks knows it. Again, it's as if the Postal Service were giving carte blanche to protect our national legacy, and they've done a rotten job at it. Not only should we try to close down some of these rather dubious pork parks, but we also ought to try to privatize where we can so that individuals out there who would like to make a profit are able to do so by providing recreational opportunities for the American public, and that's not such a bad thing.
We have heard Bill Chandler, Vice President for Conservation of the National Parks and Conservation Association, and Jerry Taylor, Director of Natural Resource Studies at the Cato Institute. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
In the fall season, we are familiar with a southward trek of many wild bird species. But birds are not the only creatures to migrate on the wing. At this time of year, butterflies are also on the move, sometimes in opposite directions. The best known is the orange and black monarch, which makes its way from North America to Mexico. Jeff Glassberg is the president of the North American Butterfly Association in Morristown, New Jersey. He tells us of their journey.
They fly all the way from Canada and Maine into Mexico, into the mountains of the Transvolcanic Range about 3-4 hours west of Mexico City, and they spend the winter there at about 10,000 feet in the fir forest.
But butterflies don't just fly north to south. Some butterflies migrate in the opposite direction.
As we speak right now, for example, a butterfly called the cloudless sulfur is streaming northward throughout much of North America. It's basically a butterfly found in the very south, southern parts of the United States normally. But late in the summer, they just decide they want to head off, and they start flying north really throughout the continent. But again, it's especially concentrated along the coasts. And they hit the New York area about a week and a half ago, and they're still going north. Probably up into Maine and eastern Canada. And these are kind of large yellow-green butterflies. And what happens to them, no one really knows. Of course, they can't survive the winter up there. And so we don't know if some of them make it back down or not.
Scientists tell us we know very little about butterfly migration. Glassberg says that perhaps this mystery is what has sparked the human imagination over the millennia.
The ancient Greeks considered them to be the repositories of the souls of human beings, and they used the same word, psyche, to describe the human soul and butterflies. In South America, in Paraguay, in the language of Paraguay, which is Guarani, or at least a secondary language of Paraguay, the word for butterfly is Tupanambi, which means the ears of the gods. And again, they call that because of their ubiquitousness in the forests and the shape of their wings looking like the ears of the gods.
This is Peter Burley, hoping that as you see the passing butterfly, the ears of the gods will be opened to you, and you will be brushed by the soul of a departed loved one.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Thomas Lally.
And I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 300. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. Funding support for the Environment Show comes from Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE. So long. Join us next time for the Environment Show.